Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this November 2010 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening's scientific reporting endeavors, Jim Campanella. Let's just get started. The first story is an update already on the exoplanet story I told about last month. You may remember how I mentioned that no habitable exoplanets had yet been found, and I thought that I waxed quite eloquent on why that was such a worry to astronomers and biologists. Well, there was a report, and then a repudiation of that report, all in the last month or so, that a habitable planet had been found. If that sounds confusing to you, I suspect it is no less confusing to the astronomers. Let me explain. In late September, about the time that I was recording my October science news, an experienced group of U.S. astronomers made headlines with news of the first extrasolar planet likely to be hospitable to life. The planet lay at a distance from its parent star at which water could be liquid. The report was in the Astrophysical Journal and was written by Dr. Paul Butler of the Carnegie Institution for Science and his colleagues. Butler was quote-unquote thrilled because it only took 15 years to find a habitable planet. Butler also said in a press conference, quote, "Over the next 10 years, I would be shocked if there weren't many dozens of these things," unquote. Butler's planet was one of six known to be orbiting the red dwarf Gliese 581, the current record holder for most planets orbiting a star other than the Sun. Well, as the poor schmucks who invented cold fusion will tell you, if no other scientist can reproduce your work, then it becomes worthless and meaningless instantly. A Swiss team of veteran planet hunters has now cast some doubt on Butler's finding. Less than 2 weeks after Butler's paper was published, Dr. Francesco Pepe of the Geneva Observatory in Switzerland announced at the extrasolar planet meeting in Torino, Italy, that a combination of old and new data acquired by his team showed no sign of that planet that Butler's group had dubbed Gliese 581G. Pepe said, "If a signal corresponding to the announced Gliese 581G planet was present in our data, we should have been able to detect it." Other astronomers say that only time and more studies will tell if the first exoplanet in the habitable zone has truly been found or not. How reliable are these Swiss scientists? Well, in 2009, when they made their last report about planets orbiting Gliese 581, they had 119 measurements of the star's wobble, a telltale sign of unseen planets tugging back and forth on the star. Now, 119 measurements may not seem like very many, but they were recorded over 4 years. Those measurements revealed a total of 4 planets circling the star. The team's latest report includes an additional 60 measurements made with the sensitive HARPS spectrograph on the telescope at La Silla, Chile, for a total of 6.5 years of observations. "From these data, we can easily recover the 4 previously announced planets," says Pepe. "However, we do not see any evidence of a 5th planet in an orbit of 37 days. Since this is an argument between scientists, it will only be resolved over time when one group or the other can show that their own data is more accurate. So far, I vote for the Swiss, who seem to be much more conservative and not quite so quick to jump the gun and into the spotlight. Only time will tell, though, how things eventually turn out." Again, in a reference to a story from last month, I wrote about how accents and truth are perceived by listeners. After writing that, I became a bit more intrigued about what sorts of papers might be out there that deal with voice and accent and perception and the like. And I was surprised to see that there's actually a journal called, yes, The Journal of Voice. I thumbed through the latest issue from October and found some very interesting stories. Probably the most interesting was one entitled "Noise and Tremor in Perception of Vocal Aging in Males." The story was written by Dr. James Harnsberger and his associates at the University of Florida. Basically, they looked at several factors that they thought would alter perception about the age of a male speaker, including voice tremor, speaking rate, and quote-unquote added noise, which I interpreted as being phlegminess. To identify the acoustic and perceptual correlates of the aging voice, voice quality was systematically manipulated using computer resynthesis to determine its effect on perceived age. 10 young male voices were resynthesized using 2 levels of phlegminess and 2 levels of tremor, under a speaking rate manipulation. An increase in speaking rate is common in older male voices. These recordings were then played to 40 listeners in an age estimation task. Two sets of comparison materials were also included for evaluation. The unmanipulated samples from a 150 voice database of young, middle-aged, and old voices, and disordered voice samples representing natural manifestations of the voice qualities of interest. Why do the authors think that it's important how we identify voices? Let them tell you themselves. Here is the opening paragraph from the paper. Quote, "Speaker age is an attribute of the speech signal that is conveyed simultaneously with the signal's linguistic content along with many other indexable properties of speech, such as a speaker's emotional state, health, stress level, and dialect, to name a few. It is an aspect of the speech signal that is easily identified by listeners and may, like other indexable properties, influence the perception of linguistic information, particularly in more degraded listening environments. Finally, speaker age is certainly a confounding factor in the analysis of pathological voices, with subsequent consequences for the assessment and treatment of voice disorders." Unquote. Okay, that's a bit much. How about let's try the opening paragraph of the methods section. Quote, "The purpose of this present study was to determine the perceptual relevance of selected cues by systematically manipulating them in age perception tests. Two primary cues were selected, noise and tremor, corresponding to two attributes of voice that may co-occur or increase with chronological age. These cues were manipulated through resynthesis in combination with two secondary cues under examination, that is, mean fundamental frequency and speaking rate." Unquote. Okay, well, that's better. So, old people talk faster, have a lower mean voice frequency, and sound tremory and phlegmy. And young men have slower voices at a higher frequency without the tremors or the phlegminess. Well, that was their prediction. So what was the result? They found that higher speaking rates, the highest degree of synthesized tremor, and the highest degrees of synthesized phlegminess all shifted the listener's perceptions in an additive manner. In other words, the listeners concluded that the mean perceived age of the young male voices were older by an average of 12 years. So someone who was 30 would have been perceived on average as being 42. Some listeners went way beyond the 12-year average and gauged individual voices as being shifted by at least a generation up to 25 years older. So a normal male voice at 30 would be judged as being in their mid-50s. When the researchers altered the fundamental frequency of the voices and shifted it downward, there was no statistical effect on the perceived age of the speaker. They concluded that voice quality, both tremor and phlegminess, and speaking rate are all perceptually relevant cues of determining age in male voices. I don't know of any practical applications for this knowledge, except for psychologists or for anybody who's an actor or a narrator. These cues are actually rather good things to know. They can make a voice portrayal of someone who is older much more believable and accurate. So all of you who are Starship Sofa narrators out there, take note. I certainly will be doing so for my future narration duties. The next story gave me a bit of a shiver because my own website, Uvula Audio, has been podcasting the narration of At the Mountains of Madness for the last few weeks. And by the way, Craig Nickerson, our narrator on that novel, does a fantastic job, and I recommend it highly to anyone who likes H.P. Lovecraft. Just follow the website link here on the sofa that accompanies my name and go over to the adult bookstream area. Anyway, if you're not familiar with Lovecraft's master work, it follows a group of American explorers in the Antarctic who come across the remains of an ancient civilization on the order of millions of years old, set in the highest mountain peaks on Earth, which have been hidden down there. The story is terrifying, despite the fact that it's been used as the fodder for 1,000 other lower quality stories since it was written 70 years ago. By the way, Guillermo del Toro is making a film version of At the Mountains of Madness that should be coming out next year, with Ron Perlman presently cast as the lead scientist, Dr. Dyer. What does this have to do with a science story? No one has found any Shoggoths yet, but they have discovered some other very cool stuff down in Antarctica. Buried deep beneath East Antarctica's ice sheet, the Gambersef Mountains are the world's most invisible range, and probably the least known of any mountain range on Earth. New research published last month in the Geophysical Research Letters by Dr. Stephen Cox at Caltech suggests that the overlying ice that's hiding them from view today could have preserved their rugged topography for the past 300 million years. Russian scientists first identified the Gambersefs in 1958 as part of a survey during the International Geophysical Year, and geologists have since puzzled over them about how that range came to be. The mountains are in a stable part of the continent that hasn't seen much tectonic activity in more than 500 million years. Cox says, quote, "The Gambersefs are either really, really old, or some big part of the tectonic puzzle is missing here." Cox's team tried to answer the question of how they came about by looking at how quickly the mountains eroded over time. Because the range is buried under thousands of feet of ice, researchers had to study it indirectly. Cox's team did this by probing mineral grains at the bottom of Pride's Bay in East Antarctica, where pieces of rock that washed off the Gambersefs ended up. Grains of the mineral apatite were analyzed to determine the cooling age of the rocks. That told how fast the mountains actually eroded. Cox's team analyzed the apatite in two ways: the amounts of uranium, thorium, and helium it contained, and the number of quote-unquote fission tracks left by decaying uranium. They used all that to build a cooling history of the Gambersefs. The team concluded that over the past 250 million years, mountains inlet of Pride's Bay eroded just 2 to 5 kilometers. That is 10 times slower than modern erosion in places like the Alps. Earlier studies had suggested slow Antarctic erosion over the past 118 million years, but this new study goes back even further in time and supports the idea that the Gambersefs are really ancient. Cox says that, quote, "cold glaciers or ice sheets atop the mountains could have protected them from wearing away," unquote. Wow, just imagine what might be down there under all that ice. It boggles the mind and the imagination. I know that if I was Guillermo del Toro and I was updating and rewriting at the Mountains of Madness for modern audiences, I would certainly start with global warming uncovering the Gambersefs and the remains of the old ones. Wow, imagine that. Anyway, I know Lovecraft would have been laughing his head off if he had survived until the actual discovery of the Gambersef Mountains in the late 50s. Okay, on to the next story, which I am almost loath to mention. Every time I bring up this topic, I get more depressed and more worried. I feel like somebody holding up a placard that says the end is near. Yes, if you hadn't guessed, this is a BPA update. BPA, if you don't follow this podcast regularly, is bisphenol A, which is a compound found in plastics which mimics the hormone estrogen. I have gone on at length in the past why this is so dangerous as an environmental toxin. Well, you may remember a few months back, I mentioned that cash register receipts actually have as much as 1,000 times more BPA than can be found in any plastic bottle. At the time I mentioned it, no one knew how dangerous that actually was. Well, a new study in the journal Chemosphere this month by Dr. Daniel Zalko of the French National Institute for Agricultural Research shows unequivocal evidence that BPA from receipts can go through human skin and be absorbed into the body. Zalko and his co-workers collected pig ears from slaughterhouses within 5 minutes of the animals being killed. Then, in less than 2 hours, the tissues were in the lab, where researchers removed the skin from the ears, cut it into tiny discs, and cultured each disc in a dish. The scientists then applied BPA at various concentrations to the dry outer surface of the skins. The lowest concentration used by Zalko was in the ballpark of what could rub off onto an equivalent area of skin from handling a standard receipt paper. After 3 days, more than half of the BPA had diffused through the skin and into the growth media. Zalko says, quote, "In a living animal, the diffused chemical would likely be circulating in the blood throughout the body," unquote. Enzymes active in the skin transform the majority of BPA into metabolites known as conjugates. A conjugate is a version of the BPA with a chemical addition or add-on. BPA principally is converted into the compounds BPA glucuronide and BPA sulfate. To validate the value of pig skin as a human test replacement, Zalko's group also ran the BPA experiments using tiny samples of healthy human skin that had been removed from abdomens of roughly 40-year-old women during various surgical procedures. Again, almost half of the BPA passed completely through the skin. And Zalko cautions that this pass-through rate might be conservative since the cultured human skin samples weren't as fresh, and therefore not as porous as the pig ear skin had been. Moreover, far less of the BPA exiting the human skin was conjugated compared with the pig skin, and what had been transformed was less likely to be in the glucuronide form. In other words, a lot of that BPA was still in the active BPA form in the human skin. This is all very worrisome. Several companies are now working on BPA-free thermal receipt paper, but as consumers, I'm not sure that we will know the difference. I hope that the companies have enough sense to label the receipts BPA-free so that we can at least be able to handle receipts again without becoming paranoid. The next story of the night is another fish story. Sort of a continuation of the flying fish story from last month. I guess at some point I got sidetracked from all my ant stories and got onto fish somehow. Last month, the question came up of how it was that flying fish could fly. Well, this month's question is, how do blind cavefish navigate when they have no eyes at all to detect light? Doctors Gordon Mallinson and John Montgomery of the University of Auckland, New Zealand, tried to answer this question in the latest all-fish physiology issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology. The blind cavefish have no eyes at all. The authors explained that all fish sense their environment using velocity sensors on their skins and pressure gradient sensors along both sides of their bodies. These are known as lateral lines, and again, all fish have these. The cool thing is that for blind cavefish, these pressure and velocity sensors are their main sensors for detecting their surroundings, since that's pretty much all they have. The researchers were curious to know how the fish's surrounding hydrodynamic fields changed as they encountered obstacles. So they put the blind cavefish into a digital particle image velocimeter. This is a system they built to visualize the fluid flowing around the fish. This analysis is now going to sound very similar to how the flying fish were analyzed, but here we go. They released the blind cavefish, ranging in size from 40 to 60 millimeters, into this velocimetry system, and then they shined a plane of laser light into the tank and filmed the water swirling as the fish swam through the laser plane. Following the fish as it paralleled a wall as it swam was easy. Quote, they follow surfaces, so if you have a square tank, they just keep going around and around the outside, unquote, according to the authors. However, recording the fluid flows as the fish approached a wall head-on was much more difficult. The scientists had to direct the fish out into quote-unquote open water by placing an obstacle in its path and forcing them to head directly into the opposite wall. They analyzed the velocity of the water flowing around the fish's nose and along its sides. Then they calculated the pressure field that the fish detects with its lateral lines. They compared the pressure field surrounding the fish in the open water with the pressure field as it approached a wall head-on to determine how the water movement changed around the fish. Montgomery said, quote, when the movement is away from a wall, there is a stagnation point. That's where the flow is coming straight into the nose of the fish. From the point of view of the fish, the flow stops and there's a very high pressure, unquote. They found that as the fish approached the wall head-on at a distance of 8 to 12 millimeters, the team detected the stagnation point widen and spread across the fish's nose. The stagnation point pushed the pressure way up around the nose of the fish, warning the fish that it needed to change course to avoid collision. When the blind fish swam parallel to the wall at a distance of less than 4 to 6 millimeters, the authors saw the stagnation point slip around to the side of the fish's head, closer to the wall, and spread wide as the pressure rose. So the pressure at the side of the fish head also dropped as the fish neared the wall. Next, the team was curious to find out how these pressures and velocity features varied as the fish swam at different speeds and distances from the wall. After additional study, they found that the fluid flow patterns hardly changed even at the highest speeds. The author said, quote, everything just scales with the velocity and the form doesn't change. If a fish is sensitive to a certain relative change, say a doubling, it will pick it up at pretty much the same distance irrespective of how fast it's swimming, unquote. In other words, speeding up does not help the fish detect more distant objects because the hydrodynamic changes in the water occur at the same distance from the obstacles regardless of their speed. Also, moving fast gives the fish less time to respond to any structure nearby. So you would expect that the blind cavefish would swim more slowly in new places, but that doesn't seem to be the case. They swim faster in unfamiliar water. Now, the question then became, why would they have such odd behavior? Well, here's one possible answer. The authors suggest that by swimming fast, the fish increases the fluid flow around their body, making the hydrodynamic signal stronger and easier to interpret in a noisy environment. They also suspect that the fish probably keep close track of the location of the stagnation point and other flow features on the surface of their bodies. Montgomery says, quote, "They can use all that flow data to interpret how things change in time and space to help them avoid obstacles in the dark." Unquote. The last story of the evening was suggested to me by Tom Alerts, one of our listeners. And forgive me if the pronunciation of your name is way off, Tom. Tom noticed this story in the popular press, and I tracked down the original article. It is entitled, quote, "Feeling the Future, Experimental Evidence for Anomalous Retroactive Influences on Cognition and Effect," by Dr. Daryl Bem of Cornell University. The paper is in press in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Well, for those of you who didn't figure it out immediately, yes, the paper is about one of the oldest tropes in science fiction, telepathy and precognition. Bem claims to have the first unbiased evidence of psi powers in humans. The fact that his name is the standard acronym for bug-eyed monster is only appropriate frosting on the cake, I guess. Bem tells us that a survey of 1,100 college professors in the United States found that psychologists were more skeptical about the existence of psi powers than any of their colleagues in the natural or social sciences. 34% of psychologists in the sample declared psi to be impossible, a view expressed by only 2% of all other respondents, which, by the way, I find just absolutely an amazing statistic. Bem tries to be as unbiased in his presentation as possible, pointing out the two major stumbling blocks for psi researchers. He points out that they are, quote, empirical and theoretical. The empirical challenge is to provide well-controlled demonstrations of psi that can be replicated by independent investigators. Bem tells us that that is the major goal of his article. The theoretical challenge, on the other hand, is to find an explanatory theory for the alleged phenomenon that is compatible with physical and biological principles. So what does Bem report in this study? He did 9 experiments involving 1,000 participants, and he tested, quote, "retroactive influences by time-reversing well-established psychological effects so that individuals' responses were obtained before the putatively causal stimulus events occurred," unquote. So basically, he tested whether anybody could detect an effect before the cause. My favorite of the 9 experiments was entitled "Precognitive Detection of Erotic Stimuli." I guess the idea is that sex is such a strong stimulus that it may be able to stimulate psi abilities. Let me explain. 100 Cornell undergraduates, 50 women and 50 men, were recruited for the experiment. The experiment took 20 minutes and was run completely by computer. After several minutes of New Age music and pretty cosmic pictures to calm the test subjects, pictures of 2 curtains appeared on the computer screen side by side. One of them had a picture behind it, and the other one had a blank wall. The task of the testee was to click on the curtain that they felt had the picture behind it. The curtain was then opened, permitting the testee to see if they selected the correct curtain. There were 36 trials for each of the testees. The test photos included, quote, "several pictures that contain explicit erotic images," that is, couples engaged in nonviolent but explicit consensual sexual acts, unquote. Each session of the experiment included both erotic and non-erotic pictures, randomly intermixed, and the main psi hypothesis was that the participants would be able to identify the position of the hidden erotic picture significantly more often than chance. Chance would put it at 50%, since you have 1 in 2 chance of getting it every time. The results. In the first retroactive experiment, women showed statistically reproducible psi effects to highly arousing stimuli, but men did not. Because this appeared to have arisen from men's lower arousal to the stimuli used, the experimenters introduced different erotic and negative pictures for men and women in subsequent studies, using stronger and more explicit images from the internet sites for men. They also provided two additional sets of erotic pictures so that men could choose the option of seeing male-male erotic images, and women could choose the option of seeing female-female erotic images. Okay, now here is the tricky part of the experiment. Even though it looks like the experiment was a test for clairvoyance, it was not. The participants were told that a picture was hidden behind one of the curtains, and their challenge was to guess correctly which curtain concealed the picture. That was not true. Neither the picture itself nor its left-right position was determined until after the participant recorded his or her guess, making the procedure a test for detecting a future event. That is, it was actually a test for precognition. Could the testee predict where the photo would eventually appear? Across all 100 sessions that were performed, participants correctly identified the future position of the erotic pictures significantly more frequently than the 50% hit rate expected by chance. That is, it was a hit rate of 53.1%. That is in contrast to the hit rate on the non-erotic pictures, which didn't really significantly differ from chance at 49.8%. The difference between erotic and non-erotic trials was itself statistically significant, according to the author. Because erotic and non-erotic trials were randomly interspersed in the trial sequence, BEM states that this significant difference also serves to rule out the possibility that the significant hit rate on erotic pictures was an artifact of inadequate randomization of the left-right positions on the screen. Okay, do I believe any of this? Well, first of all, I have to give BEM credit for lots of thought in his experimental design. He was trying very hard to get around all the complaints and problems that others have had with their own psi experiments. And okay, based strictly on statistics, he is seeing an effect, but it just seems to me to be barely above the level of pure chance at the 50% level. I am not convinced, at least partly because the statistics barely support his point of view. They suggest that there is barely an effect. Also, BEM goes on later in the article to do a bunch of hand-waving about quantum physics that suggests that he has an explanation for psi effects, but he doesn't really. In fact, his theories are so weak that he invokes the specter of science history. He says that there have been plenty of times in history when a scientific phenomenon was observed long before its explanation, and that psi phenomenon is just another example. I beg to differ. The big difference is, with all those other phenomena, they could be reproduced by any scientist anywhere in the world with the proper know-how and equipment. And until I see that with BEM's experiments, then I will very much doubt his outcome. Although it would be very cool, I have my doubts as to whether any of BEM's work will ever fall into that category of clearly reproducible phenomenon. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Get that phlebbiness out of your voice, unless you want to sound like your dad, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.